Log Talk Radio.
Live from Washington, D.C., it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry Online Radio. QLPOR, as it's widely known, features a bevy of poets, spoken word artists, and live poetry readings with best-selling authors. Your host is Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Good evening and welcome. The title of the episode is Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained, The Role of Poetry in Mental Health Awareness. The title is inspired by John Milton's epic poems that explores the themes of sin, suffering, redemption, and restoration. But we're not here tonight to discuss theology. No, tonight, our featured poets and spoken word artists will share the experiences of losing and finding a sense of paradise through poetry. These poets will share poetic works, illustrate how reading, writing, and or reciting poetry assisted them deal with the struggles, overcome obstacles, and embrace joys. Tonight, you will hear poetry written and or performed by Ahmad Al-Khattat, Skaya Evans, Benjamin Sheriff Goldberg, Richard Harries, Jessica Philly Park, Nicholas Michael Ravnikar, I love Nicholas, Lisa Simmons, and David Thurston, a.k.a. Bipo Phoenix. You know, it's important to remember that mental health issues are common and treatable. Seeking help is not a sign of weakness. The act of seeking help actually shows strength. One organization that is dedicated to helping is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, also known as NAMI. David Thurston knows about NAMI, and I'd like him to share a few words about NAMI's services. Hello, David.
Me?
Hello. Good evening.
Michael.
Yes.
Michael, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes. You're on the air.
All right, great. Yeah, so my family is pretty involved in the National Alliance on Mental Illnesses chapter in D.C., and NAMI D.C. is engaged with this event. It's not the whole national umbrella isn't affiliated. But NAMI D.C. provides emotional support, community, and education, and advocacy around mental health issues in the District of Columbia. There are two support groups that meet once a week each. There's a course called Family to Family that trains families in how to recognize signs and symptoms and collaborate with their loved ones. And there's a lot of other ongoing advocacy that NAMI is part of in D.C. I served as the outreach coordinator for a few years before moving on to pursue my own professional career in mental health. So I don't know if there's anything more specific I can say about NAMI, Michael, but the website is namidc.org, namidc.org.
All right. Thank you very much. NAMI is a very powerful organization. To me, being a member of NAMI, from the vantage point that they are out there to assist people who live with mental illness, who deal with mental health concerns, and again, it's so important to have, in my mind, an organization that can ally with you. So again, that you recognize you're not alone in this struggle. It's tough sometimes when you're dealing with these issues. I know. It's tough sometimes when you're dealing with these issues. Now, tonight, again, our program, the poets will perform and share their work in a round-robin fashion. And I'd like to begin by sharing a piece by Lisa Simmons, who lives on Lake Garda in Italy. This is her original piece, and the piece is titled, I Think I Understand.
This one's called I Think I Understand. I think I understand cutting now, as much as someone who doesn't do it can. I know the feeling of I cannot live in this skin, the feeling of when is this hurt going to end, the feeling of how to get rid of this pain, how to distract my brain. I think I understand cutting now, divorcing oneself from the gasping, midnight, wake, shivering, shaking, quake. I thought I was going to die, but here I heave and lie. Here I heave and lie. I think I understand cutting now, when there's no other choice, when you can't see beyond, when this moment is all, when I am feeling so small and I cannot grip. Every signpost lost, no touchstone healed, no distraction to be found, no song to be sung, no words to be read, no solve for the wound, no spot that is safe, no respite, no grace. I think I understand cutting now. Layers thick, all my lives heaped like bricks, covering my inadequacies, covering insecurity, walling up the interior, covering what's past and done and gone, safe from probing exteriors, buried deep, so deep I cannot reach down, down so deep, only revealed on the cusp of sleep. When defenses are released, when I'm almost at peace, then the jerk, the pulling up, the breathless inhale as I flail, and there it is. Though I'd hoped last time was the final time, but here it is, the gasp, 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 the gasp. Gasping, midnight, wake, shivering, shaking, quaking. I think I understand cutting now. End of poem.
That was Lisa Simmons, an internationally renowned multidisciplinary artist. I'd like to thank her for her contribution. I'd like to now move to Ahmad Khatat.
The federal.
Ahmad, you're on the air.
Okay. So my first poem, the title will be, "You No Longer Have Hands." You destroyed the journal I had kept for years. I feel ashamed to read my sorrows with a language other than my mother tongue. Beautiful silky skin and blue watery eyes are the reasons why my disappointments are left. In my shadow, I see myself free from the coffin, yet everyone dies when I pretend to be asleep. I jailed my poems, my tales, and tears in my heart. The prisoners ask if I'm ready to close my eyes. I give him my watch and say, tell him, take the time and slaughter me. You'll peel my skin and sip my blood in less than a year. You no longer have hands to bury my dreams. Oh, Baghdad, why am I in the blues when I feel like a dead soldier in a fire or a stranger in Montreal corners, lots of bare hands with blood splitting on my sad face? Thank you.
Ahmad, thank you. Tell us where you hail from, Ahmad, and more about your story in terms of your writing.
All right, so my full name is Ahmad Al-Khatat. I'm 34 years old. I'm originally from Iraq, but I live in Canada. The reason why I suffer from mental illness is because when I was 21 years old, I used to date this girl back home. She was in my country, and I was in Montreal, Canada, of course. And we dated for almost like 2 years, and everything was fine. And at some point, you know, I decided to go and meet up with her. But sadly, due to the war we had back in the day, the situation didn't allow me. So, sadly, all I heard was I was rejected to get a visa. And then within a few days, the girl that I used to be and fall in love with, she passed away from an explosion that happened, a terrorist explosion happened back home. And since then, I'm always suffering in depression and dealing with mental illness of missing her.
So how has poetry been able to assist you, my friend?
Well, because you feel like I take poetry as a meditation, you know, as a way to escape from my grief. And that's why, you know, like every time when I write a poem, I always put her in my mind and write about her because, you know, she was right. Special. She was my first one.
All right. Thank you. Our next poet is Benjamin Sharif Goldberg. Welcome, Benjamin.
Hey, everybody. Hey, Michael.
Hello.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having us all. I'm Ben, and neurodivergent poet and teacher living here in Southern Maryland, living in Waldorf, originally from Michigan. And I'm going to read a poem called To the Boy Breaking His Hand Against a Wall. And this is after the poet Kim Adonisio, who wrote a poem that inspired this called To the Woman Crying Uncontrollably in the Next Stall. All right. To the Boy Breaking His Hand Against the Wall. If a room's description ever made you relive the elided crimes within, if you were forced to see once more because you saw just once, to hold a loved one you discovered shivering and hidden, to see and hold yourself like this, if you learned to know your only offering was hands to throw against what comes for you, for yours, if you tracked his socials, Matthew Chabot, and found the architect of sadness smirking back through storm door, plaster, fiberglass window, cinder block, or skin, if you tried, as told, forgiveness, but no, because fuck that, if all of this, if none, but still this wall, please listen, your hand is speaking, its bones are softness, each of them, of us, so much of us, is softness. Thank you.
Tell us more, if you're willing, Ben, about your story.
So, yeah, kind of a love. I think love did it for me, too. Mine did not end with her dying. Mine ended with her just leaving. And that was the manifestation of what I now understand or believe to be borderline personality disorder. It's a long story about how to sort, kind of sorting through all of the diagnoses to make sense of what actually was going on. And if there's time, we can talk about that. But that traced a lineage of other things back to before that. Here we are.
Yes.
Borderline and living.
So how did poetry assist you navigate through life?
So originally, poetry, I think, kind of gave me a purpose. In high school, when I kind of fell in love with poetry, I found in it a reason to keep existing. And sometimes that was really urgent. Like, that was day to day a necessity. Here's another reason to make it another day, to exist another day, to live this day for. And I guess my relationship with poetry has evolved. I've come closer to it and stepped further away from it, but it's always kind of been there. Wherever I was in relation to it, it's always existed.
All right. Thank you. The next poet is Skaya Evans. You're on, Skaya.
Hello.
Hello.
So I'm Skaya. I come from originally Minnesota. I live in Southeast Virginia now with my cats, who have become my emotional support figures. I also have borderline personality disorder, among other things. First piece I have is called A Full Plate. Thin, feeling like Sandra, demanding to be moisturized. It's a momentary blip, nothing specific, fueling the noise. Remnants of memories, deflated by expectations, apparently unreasonable. Talking over each other in my mind, full of effort to convince me of lies. Brain gremlins chatter incessantly, becoming micromanagement, HOA reps issuing citations. Clear out those old memories before you dare create new ones. The price paid for buried ignorance becomes the demons that taunt me every time I excavate happiness. Thank you.
Wow. Please share more of your story, Skaya, in terms of how poetry assisted you?
It's like one of those art forms. I do other visual arts too. It's one of those art forms that doesn't need a specific form. A few lines and you can capture so much emotion, or you can write something that's a couple pages long. It's whatever it needs to be to process. I use writing to process.
Okay. The process for understanding.
What I'm going through, like how to make sense of things in the world.
All right. Thank you. The next poet is Jessica Philly Park.
Hey.
Hello, Jessica. Hello. Right.
Hello, hello. All right. I'm Jessica Philly Park. I'm originally from Connecticut, but I've lived in D.C. for like 28 years. Host a poetry open mic called the Guerrilla Poetry Insurgency, although we're mainly online now, but still doing it every second Tuesday of the month. Thank you so much for having me on. This is amazing. And can you hear me?
Yes, please share a poem.
Okay, cool. Sorry. I didn't hear you for a second. Okay. All right. I'll share one. This one is called I Think We All Get Stuck. I think we all get stuck at the maturity level of where we were when the first really bad thing in life happened to us. For me, it was when my dad died. He was in his 50s, too young. I cried for what seems at least a year. I was 23. I finished college a little late, so 23 was the first year of a real job, even though I had jobs since I was 16. Money was shit, but it was mine, so no funds from the folks and student loan payments sucked, but I was an independent woman. An independent woman who could spend her money on how she wanted and not worry about getting up early for class. Scholarship education actually kept me pretty tame in school compared to my newbie college mates. I didn't do as many drugs as them, but I did love to party. And once you're on your own, there's no guilt in partying. That money you're spending is yours. That time you're burning is yours. That responsibility you're shirking is yours. My boss must have loved me. So it was in my early 20s. I was at the bars, at the clubs, even sometimes on a weekday, and that was living life to me. When my dad died, then I continued my shenanigans, and the cheaper version was bringing the bottles home. I was an adult, and playing as one, I could do legally what I once snuck into the dorm rooms, and I had lots of company. Associating drinks with happy was an easy psychological thing to do. It's okay to dabble, not dive, but I dove deep. So I got stuck at 23. Now I'm really finally trying to get unstuck because I'd like to give 46 a shot. Did you get stuck somewhere? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What about poetry assisted you, Jessica?
I started writing in high school, and I remember I was probably like 15 or something, and I remember going, as teenagers do, they kind of, at least I did, I got depressed. And I kind of just discovered poetry through that, like doodling one day, writing words. I've never been great at art, but I've always been drawn to writing in words, and it just helps you work through things, and listening to other people's poetry makes you feel less alone. I often say that poetry and sharing poetry is like we're therapizing, and Michael, I know you've heard me say therapize.
Yes.
Before, we know it's not a word, but it just helps. And there's been a lot of stuff throughout life, obviously the death of my father, very significant, but other loss, and we all know what it's like to spiral, and or maybe we don't all know, but poetry is one of those things. If you can get in it, you might work out some of those things and just help keep you up.
All right.
For another day.
All right. Thank you. All right. Our next poet is Nicholas Michael Ravnikar. Hello, Nicholas.
Hello, Dr. Ingram. Thank you very much for this episode. I guess I would just say that I'm a poet and scholar living in Racine, Wisconsin. I've got multiple diagnoses of borderline personality disorder, bipolar 2, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, ADHD, and dysthymia persistent depression. So I am very divergent when it comes to my neurons. I'm also a recovering alcoholic addict. I've been sober for 12 years, and I actually completed the NAMI peer-to-peer 12-week introductory course that was developed at the national level, and I found that really helpful after my more recent nervous breakdown in 2021. I'm also the publisher of Paper Knives Small Press, so I hope that all of the folks listening get a chance to check that out, because I'd also like to provide a voice for people who are dealing with mental health conditions, whether those are diagnosed or not, through writing. The first piece that I'm going to read in our episode tonight is called Open Wounds. You ever spend a lifetime tearing yourself to pieces just to find a reason to put yourself together? The deepest well I ever fell down never ended. A series of darknesses that flew past. Because there are sad parts of life we cannot miss, and our lives must absorb our bad decisions. While I stayed scar still and blunted as the hands that pushed me, in the stillest danger, I swear I'm on the verge of always leaving. I worried how the plummet would feel if it ever ends. So if you've thought it's hard to want what's good for you bad enough, you're not alone. And that is the end of that poem.
All right. How did you find poetry, Nicholas? How did you find it? And how did it assist you?
I tend to think that poetry found me. I don't really remember a specific time at which I decided to start writing, but I recently got a copy of a poem I wrote when I was about 6 or 7 for my dad on his birthday. So I know that I was writing poetry that young. I don't think I really became aware of it as a kind of catharsis or release probably until I was in junior high. I think probably 7th grade was when a lot of the emotions that the intense emotions really started to surface, like they couldn't be suppressed anymore.
All right.
I think poetry really helped with that.
All right. Thank you. All right. Our next poet is David Thurston, a.k.a. Bipo Phoenix. Hello.
Hey, Michael.
Hello, David.
It's good to be here. Thank you for hosting this.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to figure out what I should read and what fit most with the theme. And a couple of people have brought up the language of neurodivergence and neurodiversity, so I thought I would read a poem that fit with that. This poem is called Neurodivergent. I wrote it last July. Here you go. What if my evolving diagnosis is so much more than pathology? What if it's not illness? What if it's capacity? I feel these burning questions reverberating karmically. I feel the power of empathy, fractals of neurodivergent chemistry. These fractals of psychotropic water, synaptic fluid pregnant with power, churning in waves of emotion, burning with the aquatic fire of devotion. Fierce oscillations of mood can leave me exhausted and dry, but these seismic tectonic forces can be portals to prescient insight. We navigate a din of voices, seeking grace, love, and light. We find nation divine power, seeking roots within our minds. This is neurodivergent revolution, encompassing the... We set sail to claim liberation. We ride the waves and become whole. We craft sacred texts, sharing the wisdom that we know. Our neurodivergent army learns to swim and create, evolving to fuse with waves and to grow.
Wow. Share some more of your story, David, and how poetry assisted you.
Well, my name, the name of my creative identity is Bipo Phoenix, and BYPO is my first name. It's a riff on the word bipolar. I kind of was starting to get into street art actually at the time, and I wanted like a tag that was kind of, you know, would put mental health out there, but also would kind of like not just accept the dominant narrative. So I didn't want to just write bipolar. I turned it into my own word and made it my own little branding. And then I went through a really rough depression a few years later, and I came out of it, and a friend told me that she always knew I'd come back from it, but I'm a phoenix. So I took that on as the second part of my name. Mental health stuff started becoming really severe for me in 2004. So it's been almost 20 years. And art has been a critical part of exploring and healing. Both visual art with abstract painting and street art, but especially poetry. I started sharing my work with others in 2008, and I started publishing online in 2010. And there's a while where I didn't write anything. I didn't publish anything new because I was so deeply depressed between like 2011 and 2016. But all told, I've got about 580 some poems on my website. So if you want to check it out, you can just go to BYPO. You can Google BYPO, Bipolar, you'll probably find it quickly, or you can go to BipolRevolution.com, which is the full name of the website, BYPOREVOLUTION.com.
All right. Thank you. I'd like to share a piece. And the title of the piece is Sisyphus and Albert. Many years ago, I read famed French philosopher Albert Camus' existential essay, The Death of Sisyphus. In Greek mythology, Sisyphus was the scheming king in Greek mythology who delighted in tricking the gods to achieve his own personal gain. Sisyphus was condemned by the gods to a pointless task of rolling a large rock up a mountain, only to watch it roll repeatedly downhill for eternity. This is Sisyphus and Albert. Sisyphus, I read the words of Albert Camus last night. He stated that your eternal millstone to roll a giant boulder up a hill, reach the top, and repeatedly watch it roll down again was well earned. I wholeheartedly agree with his assessment of your mythological task. I read the words of Albert Camus last night. His reflections on the absurdity of life made me think about my own existence, the unceasing struggle to differentiate the real from sometimes the views are so blurred that I get perplexed finding the difference between hazel stones and flowers. So I cannot help but wonder if, like Sisyphus, I too will roll a boulder up a hill forever. I read the words of Albert Camus last night. His reflections on the absurdity of life again made me think about my existence. No, I have done nothing wrong. Unlike you, I neither reveal Zeus's secrets to Aesopus, nor have I been cruel to humanity. I have not cheated death twice, once, but twice, no. And Hayes is yet to be given as my current address. My crime is that I wear a mask to hide my real self. Invisible, yet visible, I dart through speech, conversations, and love relations so that no one would discover that I live with a mind that does not love me. The chatter in my head is not gentle. That of a tiny baby. It does not exude warmth. It does not do the body good like milk was erroneously believed to do so. I read the words of Albert Camus last night. A troubled mind is the boulder that I repeatedly roll up a hill. Every day I push it up to the top of my mind's mountain, only to watch it crash down before midnight, never ending, never ceasing chaos caused by the light, triggered by the world. I read the words of Albert Camus last night. Afterward, I could not sleep. So what I'd like this group to do is to think about what you've heard in the first round of the round robin, any word or phrase, anything that came to mind, and let's talk. So I'm going to open the lines for everyone. All right. Here we go.
I cannot sleep tonight.
Hold on 1 second, please.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Sorry. Okay, the lines are open for everyone. All right. They heard the words of Albert Camus. All right. So let's talk. That first round was very powerful. Well, before we do that, let me share my story. I live with mental illness, and I have so for 40 years. It's been a terrible journey. And I've often said I wouldn't wish my life on anyone else as a consequence of it. So poetry for me allowed me to free, to be my own man in a sense. My mind could not control my poetry, and that saved me. Yeah. All right. Let's go, good people. What did you hear? Any word or phrase that came to mind?
One of the things that I wrote down is just that we share loneliness. I don't know if you want me to expound on that or if you want to hear what other people also thought. So.
Okay, I think it might be better if you go continue, all right?
Sure. Yeah, so I thought that, you know, this idea that we share loneliness sort of resonated with me just because, you know, in hearing everybody's story, one of the things that I felt in common with is the sense that, right, identifying that there is a mental illness and that mental health is something that I can struggle for or strive for, started to open up the experience that I have of feeling isolated from the rest of the world. And so that, you know, the sense that like I'm living with my problems, or I think you said in your piece, right, that you're triggered by the world, right? And it very much feels like living in a state where I feel triggered by the world nearly constantly has me in a state of isolation. But through conversations like this and through hearing other people's poetry, there's a sense that maybe my perception of my own loneliness isn't necessarily accurate, that there are other people who are experiencing the world in roughly similar ways.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Thank you, Nicholas.
Yeah, similarly in terms of things that I'm hearing and relating to, Gaia said excavate happiness, and I just wrote that down because I'm very much interested in that idea and concept. And, you know, with poetry, it's like, you know, somebody says that, it's such a simple phrase, and you just put two things together, and you're like, yes, aha, you know, that's it. And in this particular case, you know, interesting to know what people, how they excavate happiness. And it's also been making me think on, you know, just deeper psychological things as of late in terms of, you know, some of the more existential questions about life and what is life and, you know, is it distraction? You know, so that's kind of all that sort of bubbled up for me when I heard that. If anybody wanted to comment more, go for it.
Right. Anyone?
Well, you know, like, okay. See, like, with, you know, like.
All right. Please.
Sorry. Okay. So, yeah, like, you know, like, sometimes, you know, like, what I love about, you know, what you're interested about poetry and mental illness, like, you know, sometimes we write poems for our own story, but sometimes when you share it in public, some people will hear it and be like, okay, thank you for sharing my story as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes me, as a poet, makes me happy to hear that. Like, you know, like, I never meet these people. I don't know them. But sometimes, you know, like, when you write those poems, when you hear, like, oh, you know, your poem makes me feel comfortable, thank you for sharing, all those comments from people, like, social media have actually, like, you see, like, made me, you know, like, even though I never met those people physically, but actually made me feel a bit better from with myself. Like, you see, made me feel like, okay, my story is heard. My pain is not anymore inside of me, you know? Like, I'm not the only one who's suffering from those kinds of mental issues. I have other people, you know, suffering. And that alone pushed me to write more about it and be more creative with it.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. We'll continue on now with our next round. And Ahmad, you're on.
Uh-huh. All right. So the next poem, for the first, So the next poem I'm going to be reading is this poem. I wrote it when I went back home for the first time because, you know, I left home when I was 5 years old and I went back when I was 25. So that was my reaction about when I saw my country after so long. So the title of the poem is Death. In my country, everything is related to death. I smell death. I swallow death. And I hear about hope and sense of death. I see death and I realize that he is a harmless angel collecting spirits as he creates more widows and orphans in the land of death. Thank you.
Thank you, Ahmad. Benjamin, you're on.
Okay. This next poem is called Fugue with Chemical Restraints and 8-Gauge Eye. And this this is about Haldol. Yes, I want it. Give it to me. Give me every gift the needle offers. I mouth off too much sometimes. At times, my veins require confiscation. I pat my upper thigh and ask again. When the tip arrives, I welcome it, remembering. A riptide sends me back to shore for practice. I drink another cup of charcoal. My brutal elsewhere is liquefied and ripple. And why not want? If not, then what? The day shift nurses count down on fingers, then circle us with palms. Past the steel beam skylights of the day room, morning happens like a wellness video, looping and on mute, like mountains in a motivational poster, whose caption slaloms calligraphically toward my atria. Don't ever let me say I wasn't held or touched enough. The nurse who holds me as gently as any father who holds a son against the mountain. His sunrise beaming from his blade, the angel announcing now is not the time. They circle chairs below the sky in group, each beam unmutes and thus loops light. A girl who leaves the ward as Lily is introduced as Adam. The boy who rates his brother sobs until he vomits. The facilitator says, that's time. Each dusk, another braid of flowers grips the floodlight. Today, we form so many lines. The receiving of construction paper and crayons, of paper cups and talcum dust beneath our tongues. Thank you.
Skaya Evans.
Okay, so I'm going to preface this by saying that the pieces I chose for tonight have kind of an overarching theme, so there's kind of a bigger story to it. This particular piece is called I Wish I Was Dead. Responsibility's gone. No worry about social acceptability. No one to offend with my lack of social skills. No one to shout at me or expect the impossible. No bills to pay or wondering about affording to eat. No more tears to cry, gasping sobs threatening to suffocate. No more being an inept human full of contradiction. No more disappointing anyone. No more awkward introversion. And in a generation or two, I'll be forgotten. A brief blip in the vast. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. Jessica?
Hello. All right. One's a newer one. It's called State of Grace. I try to keep it tight inside me because if I let it out, I'll just fall and I can't go back to where I was. I've made progress, see? Every day can be brighter, though the past wants to creep up like a shadow. Breathe in. Breathe out. Slow down. You saw me spinning. I was on a ranty tear, and you said stop. So I did. And my pulse was racing. Breath shallow and stuck. Tears were building, and hurt ached at my throat. I just sat with it, unable to distract myself, feeling the losses that will always be there. Is this our state of grace? Holding it together while demons all around us fly and wriggle and seep? We may catch each other when it's all too heavy, but how do we catch ourselves in lonely solitude? A universal thing is calling me. That is my answer right now. A universal thing is calling me out to be positive. Manifest the positivity. Create ever-loving change. Be the better, bigger person. Pick a peck of pickled peppers. Ah, good words. Breathe in and out. Don't forget your mantras. Get up. Show me how you move. All right.
Thank you. Nicholas Michael Ravnikar.
This poem is called Parable, and it was written from language that appeared in search engine results when I typed in the word insanity. I should state before I read it that it does reference rape, so if anyone's sensitive to that topic, I would recommend tuning out for the next minute, perhaps. Parable. Television shows used to put animals on trial for murder. Changing that changed a wide range of conditions that require no gym. Movies sometimes portray uncountable romance, sarcasm, math, and language. The most intense, sad things I have been locked up for serve as the basis of considerable daily exhaustion. Lately, I have been obsessed with how unambiguously America's ineffectual approach to a complete disturbance of a broad spectrum sociopathic conduct is responsible for the death of sarcasm. It is literally true that rapists can be funny, like it is literally true that rapists can found nations. But maybe our problems how ideas hurt and nobody wants to think about it. Thank you.
Great, thank you. David Thurston. Are you there, David?
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Michael, okay, sorry, I guess I was muted. I'm flipping open my current published zine of poetry, which is called, it's called Tantric Mythology, and this is the second to last poem. It's called Awakening, and it's kind of a exploration of a few interlocking dynamics kind of centering on Tantra as a way of viewing the relationship between duality and non-duality in spirituality and consciousness. This has a lot of implications for mental health and resilience in my mind. So the poem is called Awakening. My God is awareness. My God is in the aperture. My goddess is evolving, awakening, and focusing. I probe the depths of this mirror. I explore my left eye. It is the portal to my soul, the sacred gateway of desire. This torus of light solidifies. I hold it as I move. My left eye becomes a prism, seeing a kaleidoscope of vibrant hues. I nurture awareness of the erotic, awareness of emotional energy. This power is hypnotic, suffusing the air I breathe. I seek the bliss in each moment, the subtle coursing of consciousness, this bliss of noticing, awareness of all of this. God power transforms desire, enjoying the longing and the fire. This is karmic liberation, a psychotropic amplifier. I feel my pulse quickening. This bliss is a divine offering. I draw power from my suffering, crafting this tantric awakening.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to share a piece that was written by Ahmad Al-Khattat, and the title is Paradise Lost. My therapist wants me to draw signs of my mental illness. Draw me your childhood. I draw an orphan taking a selfie near the sabotaged town. Draw me your teenage years. I draw toxic thoughts, suicidal blades, and sharp objects set to cut my flesh. Draw me what's in your chest. I draw the pressure of gravity, of negativity, and a sore marathon of freedom. I begin to weep endless tears, wondering if I could ever live a normal life without being stressed and sad. I want someone to hear my tale. I'm tired of being this stranger with wounds almost impossible to recover from my sickness. People wonder if I'm furious on purpose. I love how every word comes from them to me like a bullet that learned to be invisible straight to my heart. All right. Again, we'll follow the same pattern. Please think of a word, phrase that you heard that really resonated. The lines are open and everybody's live. Just talk. Anyone can go first.
One of the things you read in that poem just really hit me. People wonder if I'm furious on purpose. And this, you know, kind of echoes, I think, a lot of what, you know, other people have been saying on this call, and that's like, I don't know, it's so hard to exist in the world with frictionlessly, you know, it's so hard to communicate the idea that the symptoms are not intentional, right? The anger is not intentional. It's not even always controllable, though that's not, you know, that's not acceptable. Like, it has to be controllable. The anger, the despair, it's unconcealable sometimes. And, you know, so many people think that it's an affectation, or it's a manipulation, or it's, you know, invention. And it's none of these things. I used to believe people when they told me that. And I'd ask myself, I spent way too long asking myself, am I making this up? And then, you know, it's actually interesting. During quarantine is when I realized possibly for the first time, no, there's no one around. And all of these things are still here. They lied to you. They lied to you, man. And it's trying to unlearn those lies.
I understand. All right. Anyone else?
I really related to the theme of desire in David Phoenix's piece, particularly, at least the way I understood it, sort of this relationship between the either-or and the both-and. In terms of the either-or, like, I definitely find myself existing in a state of black and white, kind of rigid thinking. And one of the strategies that's been really helpful in terms of recognizing when that kind of thinking is useful and when it's not appropriate for sort of gray areas, and when I need to consider the impact that emotions play in my own and other people's lives. right? Like I start to adopt this both and, trying to embrace the both and, which I think in different circles is called wise mind. So there's this really strong desire that I have for that kind of, let's say, ability to control myself or control my thoughts. But, you know, like Ben just said, I think part of the deal with living with mental illness is that it's a struggle to control my thoughts, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, the thoughts in a lot of ways are just going on in the background, and my attention sometimes is hyper-fixated on those. And so the emotions that can come from them, you know, often are uncontrollable in terms of, you know, the extent to which I can mask what's going on inside. So there's definitely a desire to cohere with the rest of reality, but also a sort of a recognition that, like, there's just different strategies that are going to be necessary for me to even hope to do that.
All right. This is, you're right, it's very difficult to control your thoughts. Because they, in many instances, I know my thoughts, they have a mind of their own. Separate from me. Anyone else?
I'll just jump in real quick to amplify a little bit of what I was hearing and was just said about desire. You know, one of the more challenging practices that you can approach from a tantric perspective is to enjoy emotions or feelings that you might at first glance label as negative. Like even something like pain, like if you're cutting onions and you cut your finger a little bit and you feel this sharp pain, you can actually choose to be grateful that you felt the pain because that meant you didn't keep cutting, you know? So even like emotions that we find as somewhat unpleasant, they exist for a reason and they exist to tell us things that we can actually learn from. And so you can also, from there, you can learn to enjoy desire for something in advance of getting it. Just enjoy the desire, the feeling of wanting, whether that's like, you know, a cup of coffee or a kiss or more or whatever. Just enjoy the desire without necessarily, like, enjoy that moment between desire and when you actually get it. And you can even enjoy desiring things that you're not going to get or things that are denied to you because a given relationship ended or whatever. You can still appreciate that you felt that that connection with creation that was involved and you're wanting to connect more deeply with someone who you're maybe not able to see in that way anymore. So I just thought I would throw that out there.
Yeah, it's really helpful. It definitely connects to the practice of, you know, mindfulness and trying to cultivate wisdom. And I mean, I take it that that's not an easy process or task to come to a point where one is consistently enjoying the desire to, for instance, like be rid of something that they're averse to. But I definitely can understand how it would be a practice that would open up a whole new range of relationships to emotion.
Mm. Other thoughts on what David shared? Is it really interesting? Anyone else?
It's a far out concept that actually kind of blew my mind a little bit just now.
What about it blew your mind?
Say about that? Well, this idea of that experiencing kind of the emotion or the feeling in between, right? Mm-hmm. We're in such a, like, you know, I guess, black and white world, right? We always say binary and all of that stuff, and it's like cause and effect, but what's in the middle? That's pretty cool. And, you know, a lot of times I walk around wondering, you know, people that seem to have it together more, is there some sort of special sauce that I'm missing, you know? And maybe that's part of the special sauce right there. I don't know.
You know, I had a therapist years ago make this statement that we do not live in a black and white world. We live in the gray, which is in between. That's where life exists. And that helped me in a way. that I did not operate just on those two poles, black or white, that there was nothing in the middle, either or, that it was a gray area. What do you think about this gray area? Is there a gray area?
Well, there's also, you know, there are situations, I mean, we're using, like, visual metaphors for reality, which is always going to be a little bit complicated. But, like, there are, I'm going to throw out a fairly concrete example of this. You know, like, there's an obvious duality between darkness and light, but neither one would exist without the other, and each creates the other. So there's actually a conceptualization of these really being manifestations of the same existence in consciousness and in reality that manifests as dark and light, but that actually you can't have either one without the other one. So there's a duality, but there's also a non-duality. And you can kind of, if you want to try to apply this to kind of mental health stuff, you know, like I have a lot of this because I'm manic depressive, so I have, you know, some pretty extreme highs and some pretty extreme lows. But, you know, it's the hardest thing. It's really easy to, like, ride the wave of elation that comes with the various gradations of hypomania and mania, but to, like, learn the lessons that the world is teaching me through depression or through anxiety, to, like, appreciate that and to learn from it, that's, like, way harder work. But it's, you know, that part of any emotion arising, it'll just stay suppressed if there's no hope of actually dealing with it. If the emotion is coming to the surface of consciousness, whatever the emotion is, there's some hope of your being drawing some kind of helpful, concrete life lesson from processing that emotion. So even a feeling of deadly despair can mean that there's something that you're ready to work on. And that's something I deal with a lot, too, just as a practicing psychotherapist. I've been kind of – I got my degree about a year ago in social work, and I've been working – at the agency where I was an intern for the prior year. And, you know, it's constantly a challenge to get people to help people to get insight into even their darkest states.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense. Also,
it does.
That reaches.
It does. Continue.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that reaches back to what Jessica was saying a while ago, right, about excavating happiness in a way. I don't know. Those unintegrated – so, you know, a lot of mental illnesses deal on extremes, right? And borderline is certainly, you know, among them, right? The binary thinking, the unintegrated kind of like – the unintegrated extremes of emotion and of conceiving of the world and conceiving of the self. And when that's the hallmark of experience and you spend so much time in that, kind of, I don't know, the idea of excavating happiness, learning to accept that as a reality and not fight it, not begrudge it or resent it, to appreciate that and say, hey, you know, like as kind of like David, what you were saying, right, as extreme or gruesome as this feels, this is an existence, right? This is a life. This is a human life, as valid as any other, and there's worth in it. And that's, you know, that's not something that one can spend all their time in. Sometimes you feel the emotion, and it's, you know, overwhelming. And then sometimes, I don't know, back to that excavating happiness, right? Like, I don't know, I'll speak for myself here. For me, that's been truest when that acceptance comes. And I haven't tried to alter any state I'm in. I just accept it.
All right. Right. Well, let's continue. Ahmad, you're on.
Yes. Thank you. So my next poem, the title is Beautiful World. When I will be less worthy, release me from this earthy. Let me go away from 90 tears. Let me go away from 90 tears and dull days, months, and years. I do not want to hear anyone near. I have heard enough. Can you hear me? You can or cannot always guess. My grief is not equal to my happiness. We try to be tighter, but we are apart. So many emotions weep in the heart. One day, I will miserably hang myself. You will have a beautiful world to yourself. Thank you.
Thank you. Benjamin Sharif Goldberg.
Okay, this next poem is called Daedalus Builds a Treehouse. And, you know, for any listeners out there unfamiliar, Daedalus, the kind of inventor and creator in Greek mythology who built the labyrinth that houses the Minotaur, and is also affiliated with his son Icarus, who famously flew too close to the sun on wings that his father made. And I was also kind of on a personal note, something that it's a word I came across, I picked up, didn't know what it meant, and it sounded like dad. So I just started calling my dad that for a while. So he indulged it. It was sweet. Anyway, this is called Daedalus Builds a Treehouse. And this is in my dad's voice. Before my son turned 6, I carved his name these places. Oaken rung of rope ladder, the plywood plank he paints. His fingers seek some twigs to whittle, kindling for flames he'll touch before he'll make. The wind adjusts. Nothing falls, is all I say, as he drops his hammer in the grass beside his shoes. He won't remain marooned in a canopy. Before the pills that douse what he can't name, before the feather in his hand means blade, I watch him use his tongue to dab the sap from each finger, then string for him a bow of birch. He chalks his palms with the wings of moths he's touched. I'm softer on him than dust. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Evans.
Says this one is called Panic Attack. You try to leave, and the demons keep dragging you back. You sit there, still, frozen, waiting for the urge to pass, the ideation of the tiny choice that will change your world. So much time spent motionless. You stop feeling your body after a while. Dissociation is what they call it. Like you're outside yourself, seeing a body you can't feel. In a way, it keeps you safe because you remain still. Harder to make dangerous choices if you stay still. The committee of critics in your brain gets louder and louder. The din becomes a dull roar, then the loudest sound you couldn't imagine. Everything gets loud. Silence is deafening. But you remain still. You must. You have to. If only to prove to yourself that you're stronger while at your weakest. A contradiction. Living inside this moment, each moment, is the strongest thing you'll ever do. Until the next moment. Second by second. Desperately clinging to anything that will give you a little more time. The moments tick by. The second hand, as deafening as the silence it sits within. Everything slows down. Still not aware of your body, that now brings an unexplained heaviness. Slogging through molasses, wearing a lead suit. Seconds seem an eternity. And when you notice the clock, only moments have passed. Every ounce of energy focused on not letting go. Can't let go. Remain still. Wait for the ideation to pass. When it does, and you feel yourself coming back to life, you exhale the breath you've been holding, despite having breathed the whole time. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Jessica, Philly Park.
All right. Thank you so much. So this is The Perfectionist Must Die. Every word we stated, every action we played, over and over, until time makes her forget. Man, I shouldn't have said that. Believe I waited so long to do that. What an idiot. Little things, big things, stuff that doesn't matter. All scrutinized the same with life or death in the balance. Each evaluated with harsh intensity to gain the upper hand on herself. Her critical inspection of every move can only lead to madness. You can see it's made her back contort and jawbone broad. Her smile does not come easy. Her laugh can only be pulled by nonsensical perversion, and a callus has formed over her whole body. The perfectionist must die. I need to kill her with 1,000 humiliations. Each strike must slice off a piece of her shielding shell till only soft, porous skin remains, vulnerable but alive. The first blows should hurt too deeply and linger in her stomach till she's sick, make her shoulders creep up to her ears and tears of embarrassment glaze her eyes. She should hurt over and over again till the every side is exposed, raw, really living. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. Nicholas Michael Rabnikar, you're on.
I really got to say thank you for getting all three names in there. It's such a, I really appreciate it. It's my, right. My preferred moniker. And so many people like to shorten it with Nick, and I really appreciate you getting every syllable in there.
All right.
This piece is called National Awareness Month Prevention Awareness. And it's an erasure poem and a list poem, which is based off of the awareness and prevention months that are federally recognized by presidential executive order. And I've taken out the words national awareness, prevention, and month. National Awareness Month Prevention Awareness. Awareness. The quality or state of being aware, knowledge and understanding that something is happening or exists, aware, having or showing realization, perception, or knowledge. Mentoring, stalking, slavery and human trafficking, American heart, Black history, teen dating violence, American Red Cross, women's history, Irish American heritage, Arab American heritage, cancer control, donate life, child abuse, sexual assault, poetry, financial literacy, Americans, Jewish American, Asian Pacific American heritage, physical fitness and sports, foster care, gay and lesbian pride, Caribbean American, great outdoors, oceans, African American music, ice cream, childhood cancer, sickle cell, alcohol and drug addiction recovery, ovarian and prostate cancer, wilderness, preparedness, childhood obesity, prostate cancer, Hispanic heritage, information literacy, Italian American heritage and culture, country music, domestic violence, arts and humanities, disability employment, cybersecurity, energy, Down syndrome, entrepreneurship, military family, bone marrow, hospice, adoption, family caregivers, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, American Indian heritage, critical infrastructure protection, impaired driving. Awareness doesn't mean we're doing anything about it. Could 1 month for lifetimes and generations of ancestors and descendants ever be enough? So what are we going to do about it? Thank you.
Thank you. David Thurston.
All right. I decided that I would just go ahead and read
the thematic glue poem to my new zine for folks, since we just got into a little exploration of the dynamics of Tantra in the last go-around. So this poem is called Tantric Mythology. Spirit moves, deeply attuned. My mind expands, duality reconstrued. My God is desire. My God is awakening. This explosion of tantric fire, our collective divinity creating. I'm a vessel for the sacred, worshiping divergent pantheons. Aztec martyrs fuse with Osiris. Bantu gods craft new songs. Yoruba spirits traverse deep waters. Yamaya and ocean, divinity's daughters. Shango's fire powers virility, fueling the tantric, making it deeper. I return to inspiration, to the fulcrum of experience. I taste the nectar of liberation. I taste your spiritual essence. I feel the pulse of your libido, exploring the resonance of your being. New consciousness gestates, orgasmic powers interweaving. My mind becomes ambidextrous, our bodies pulsating and electric, dualities and dialectics becoming fused and concentric. Circles of sacred fire unveiled before my eyes, this cauldron of divinity unleashing viscous desire. Evolve to find the joy in pain. Feel your tears and let them rain. Explore your writhing spirit and liberate. Mantras manifest, remolding our fate. Shiva and Shakti realign, copulate and intertwine. Every atom orgasmic, forging sentience divine. The carnal becomes sacred, truth unveiled by many traditions. We recreate tantric synergy. We resurrect a new religion. Find the bliss deep within. Observe the stars arising again. Kundalini fire burns inside, serpents merging your spine and mind. Worship gods of the diaspora, spirits both ancient and modern. This tradition is transformation. Tantric creation begins again. Orishas of Santeria, meeting godlings of the East, crafting new prophecy, forging liberation and peace. Sanskrit words pierce my mind, words I strain to comprehend. All that we experience is divine. Cosmic genesis courses without end.
Wow. Thank you, David. Wow. You know, I rarely write anymore. All my poems are old. As Jessica, David, and Benjamin know, I rarely ever write. And I share the same poems over and over and over again. I guess they're my comfort. So here's a piece titled, It's a Crime to Feel So Blue. It's a crime to feel so blue. Although I like the hue of blue as a color of ink in a pen, a fountain pen to be exact, one that glides gracefully across the page with certainty and purpose. Yet today there is no pen, just the color blue, and the blue stain alone doesn't dry so easily. The jagged edges and crevices that hide years of despair. It's a crime to feel so blue. Although I like the hue of blue as the color of a suit, double-breasted, if you will, sleek, secure, strong, but I'm not wearing a suit today, just the color blue, and on me, blue alone doesn't look or feel as well. It hangs, and it sags, and it weighs me down like an elevator carrying a heavy, heavy load. It's a crime to feel so blue. Although I like the hue of blue in the summertime as a backdrop for the sky, then splendid colors highlight the white puffs of cotton that speckle the horizon. That is wintertime and the cerulean skies have gone and what remains is just the color blue, now a melancholy shade. It's nothing but reminds me of the severity of my discontent. It's a crime. Crime to feel so blue. If you're my judge, either convict me or set me free. All right. I'm opening up the lines for everyone. All right. Please share your thoughts.
Michael, you should never feel bad about sharing old poetry because you know my style is quite the same. and it's so good. It's so good.
Anyone?
I really related to the line in the concept in Jessica's poem of the of perfectionism as a shielding shell, as this kind of sort of defense mechanism, and the personification of perfectionism as someone whose smile does not come easy. I really resonated with that. And, I also wanted to say that I really am digging on the, I think it's a consistent sort of theme of spirituality or spiritual practice or mindfulness practice in some way as a strategy for mental health recovery. It all seems to be common themes that I'm sensing throughout everybody's work.
All right. Anyone else? All right, then.
This is a prosaic question, but how late are we going?
We have one more round, and that's it.
Oh, okay.
Yes. We're almost there. Almost there. All right. This is the last round, unless there's another comment for round three. All right. Ahmad, you're on.
Yes. Thank you. So the title of this poem is from my new book called The Finest Cigarette. It's still in the process of editing, but soon it's going to be in the market on Amazon. So, once again, the title of the book is The Finest Cigarette. One thing about this book is going to be more poems about mental illness issue, and hopefully all the money that I will make from this book will go to mental illness institutions. So all the money and the income, all right? So the title of the poem, Smile on My Side, till the age of 18, I became an irresponsible grown-up. Drinking more than I should, eating more sugar, more than I should, smoking more than I should, all for the sake of putting a smile on my sad face. After reaching of the age of 25, I learned how to conclude my emotions. My muted tongue carried my unique accent. I carried my tears in my feeble eyes. My wounds were carried in my shattered heart, all for the sake of putting a smile on my sad face. After reaching the age of 33, I started working hard in a restaurant. I cooked my eggnog and it tastes bitter. I scrubbed the dishes with my tears and all the plates cracked in half. I prepared a new drink with my blood in. It tastes death. So here all my farewell sips for all for the sake of putting a smile on my sad face. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Benjamin, you're on the air.
This poem is called Shoreline. The flood tide took its time filling in our footprints. We sprinted up the beach. By a tuft of sea oats, I wrote my answer with a stick, as much for you as for the beach. We spent Christmas in the Keys, and your father called me godless. On a postcard, I wrote, what I love is God enough for me. On a shoal, we gathered seaweed for a reef. Night, moonless and yet, gull feathers, clam shells, white sand, calm. Past the jetties, a world happens. Past the clouds, perhaps another. Cloudlessly, day, nettles on the beach. Only once I was this cold. At camp, we huddled on the riverbank as lightning cracked the branches. I prayed, our canoes filled with river, lampreys swam beneath. Our creed, step into waves more deeply than your shiver lets you. Put a gash in what you need. Swim to atolls and leave skin from your knees. Love the sinner and the beach. That summer, loved some. Sandals, sunscreen, our bodies after and between. At night, we shook sand from our sheets. What I meant to tell you. You said to tell the beach. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. Skya.
All right. So before I read this last piece, the way that I've arranged mine is
a representation of the life cycle of an emotional storm, and from how it starts to how you go through it to how it ends. That's something that I've dealt with for a long time with the diagnoses that I have. And I think it can speak probably for a lot of people when sometimes when you're diagnosed and you don't have a support system, you don't have anybody to help you through it, you learn how to do it on your own by yourself. And I learned how to function through them by being able to tell people what was happening as I was going through them. So this is my representation. And now I'm at the part where I've come out of the storm. This one's called Note to Self. Slow down, love. You don't need to have it all figured out now. Show up with an open heart. The road will be revealed. You're where you're supposed to be, at least for now. Let people find you and love you. No convincing necessary. Life is not an interview. No one to impress. No standard questions. No what's your weakness. You design your life, even with the capitalist grind. The future remains undecided until you make a choice. Choose you. Again and again. Savor the moments. Make mistakes. Continue to show up. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Sky. Jessica.
All right. So this one's called Oh, Move On Already. And I tend to therapize myself through poetry, and this is one of those attempts. I've been pressed up against my own limits for too long, and it seems the barrier is bursting open, making me have to choose, win or lose, take a chance. But I keep looking in the rearview mirror, dwelling on mistakes of the past. Why? They don't move me ahead. They drag on my tails and roll me over. There must be a reason they creep up then overtake any lessons in the regress. Just an auto-tuned brain going to its safe space of self-destruction. It's a homey place. It's familiar. Old friends are there, always with a beer, ready to pat me on the back and ask me for more sob stories to compare to theirs. Cheers. The regret is fear, past fear, past anxiety, really, about future fear, but the future is here, and it ain't too shabby, so what's up? Why can't I just be satisfied? Let's see. Work to achieve, to make a comfy life, help others, have fun, make a difference, believe in something. Maybe belief has been missing somehow. I've got the solid beliefs, the believe in love and being good and the biggies. It's a shame because they have so many names. None of them really fit me, but the truth has never been hard to see. Ah, whose truth you say? Even fact is in question today. It's maddening the unraveling, foundation slipping away to stupidity, making goals meaningless, fleeting dreaminess we can't afford to envision while people struggle to keep living. And that's why I'm so disappointed in myself. My mind, unable to unentwine itself with things of the past, worries that shouldn't last, energy that needs to be released so I can be better for the world. Finally, graciously, carefully, fearlessly, are we done yet? Ready to get started? Great. Let's go.
Wow. Thank you, Jessica. Nicholas Michael Ravnikar.
So I have a confession to make, which is that I did not bring a fourth poem with me. And,
right, no problem.
I know I banked on the fact that that conversation and the poems would be so inspiring that I could actually write a collage on the spot.
Right.
So I've written a collage poem using language from the poems and the discussion that we've had, and I've titled it Special Sauce.
All right.
When you're triggered by the world, try to see life as perhaps a distraction, not from your emotions, but to understanding how hurt pains us. As the urgency of days evolve, another means of existence, to be whatever I need it to be. We share loneliness in all its familiar spirals, leaving home with trouble in mind, through flooded streetlights, licking air thick with dust, toxic smiles aimed at my breath again. The noises in the background could be voices. The voices in the background could be mine, tossed into amplified desires to awaken the orphaned selfies, lost in tears of words, these unconcealed thoughts I love that have a mind of their own to enjoy, the lack between cause and effect, stuck between interdependence and its opposite, somehow appears to be hopeful as it approaches the sun, to forget where we've carved a name, but to excavate it nonetheless, even if it hangs and sags. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. And David Thurston.
Okay,
are you still with us, David? Yes, I can now. Yes.
Sorry, I guess I was just talking to myself.
All right.
I was giving Nicholas some props for writing a poem in the middle of this event and it being so visceral.
That means you're in the right place. You're in the right place.
Yeah, I was just talking to myself. So anyway, I thought I would read as my last poem, a poem that I wrote kind of recently. It's called Ecstatic Joy. I wrote it in the midst of this intentional camp experience that I do a few times a year. It's out in a place called Abrams Creek in West Virginia, and it's sponsored by something called the Center for New Culture, which does these convenings where you're given space to kind of really dig deep into emotions and relationships and process stuff. And anyway, so I wrote this poem. It's called Ecstatic Joy. I feel joy, ecstatic joy, connection with these beings, connection with deep waters of transformation. Godlings of rain bless this space today, the land inundated, water finding the path of least resistance, flowing serpentine. Abrams Creek, a deluge, pregnant with energy and healing, connecting us with our spirit bodies. Our energy flows with the creek. Fluid lines materialize, then dissipate into a torrent of evolution, moving through emotion, accessing these portals to our power. I commune with kindred spirits, connecting across difference, amplifying our common humanity, creating a viscous, liquid flow of empathy. We dance like vixens, flowing through sacred water. We cry with the rain, tears of joy and shared pain. There is vision here. There is power here, forces emotional and sensual, embracing this mighty river, potent waters of intersectional liberation, conjuring magic and mystery. We envision a new culture, crafting emotional tools, tools to empower collective liberation, manifesting tantric synergy, harmonizing dualities and contradictions. Our blood pulsates, imbued with hope and unconditional love, flowing through us like a sacred river, flowing with fire like a courageous and torrential river.
Wow. Thank you, David. I'll forgo sharing a last piece. And the last poem we'll hear tonight is from Richard Harries, who lives in England. And the title of the work is Words of a Stranger.
Words of a Stranger. I was seated in a room in an old house, feeling alone but with other people. Group therapy, counseling, a facilitator present. I was telling my story of abuse, of depression, of my stepmother trying to have sex with me when I was 14. A stranger, a new member, a young man I really did not know spoke. He told me it was not my fault. I had been a kid. I was stunned. It took a stranger speaking the truth to bring me relief and forgiveness, to forgive myself for something that I had not actually done. I did have no blame. I felt lead weights lifting from my shoulders, lead weights I had carried for 30 years. I cried. I howled. I emptied myself of the guilt I should not have carried at any time, and certainly not so soon after my mother's death.
Richard Harries. Instead of a last comment in terms of questions about what we heard, I have something I'd like to ask. And so what is the role of poetry in mental health awareness? Anyone, what is the role?
Mm-hmm.
Well, personally, I think that poetry is a mode of expression that can be very elemental and can really just bring the raw, visceral experience of something to the forefront. And, you know, I'm struck by how many poets I know have some kind of mental health story in their in their past. I don't know. I don't think any kind of poetry has just one role per se, but I think that poetry is a really powerful portal into explaining things that can be hard to really articulate. Like the extremes of mood, the contradictory components of all these different things. It's like, it's hard to just put it into a paragraph, but it's easier for me to put it into a poem.
All right. Very nice. Anyone else? What is the role of poetry in mental health awareness? Someone talk to me.
I had actually done some research recently on poetry and mental health prior to finding out about this episode. And I actually found out that there's a whole modality called poetry therapy that sort of started in the 1960s, late 1960s, and has since evolved into, I think it's the International Institute for Bibliotherapy and Poetry Therapy, just sort of like the accrediting body. I'm not sure, you know, what that's worth, but anyway, there seems to be a lot of evidence-based, you know, research, clinical research that shows that engaging in poetry writing has positive outcomes for patients with who are experiencing symptoms from schizophrenia to even folks with dementia and Alzheimer's, both in terms of relieving the symptoms, but also for those who are suffering from like physical illnesses, the symptoms of which can't necessarily be directly alleviated, that it still provides what they call a positive challenge that I think does relate to what David had mentioned previously about, you know, this loving the desire, right? Or appreciating and valuing the desire that we have to get through an experience or to be alleviated of some pain. And so I think that there seems, in my experience, to be something, you know, involved in, I'm experiencing some troubling emotion or some emotion that I am perceiving as troubling. And one way that I have of getting through that is starting to write a poem. And sometimes I start writing the poem without even realizing that the reason why I've started it is because I'm experiencing some emotion. And so oftentimes the poem becomes a field that sort of exposes the emotion that I have to me. Because I wasn't necessarily aware of it before it started.
All right. You know, a number of years ago, an opportunity to write a journal or an article for the Journal of Poetry Therapy. So it's a very, very powerful group. Anyone else before we close? There is someone who's been listening, but he's not here any longer. It was a caller who wanted to share some thoughts, but he's not here anymore. So I'd like to thank all of you for participating. It's been a wonderful, wonderful evening. I've learned so much about all of you and myself included, that despite the obstacles and the negative times, I'm still okay. I regained paradise when I found poetry. I had lost it, but I regained it when I found poetry. David, in terms of NAMI, any thoughts from you?
Sorry, I just had to unmute.
All right.
Yeah, if you're in the D.C. area, I recommend connecting with NAMI D.C., the local chapter. NAMIDC.org is the website. That's NAMIDC.org. You know, we're always looking for new ways to creatively amplify the stories of resilience in the face of mental health obstacles and challenges. And, you know, we're always embracing new lines of research, new lines of inquiry, and new ways of expressing things. And you know, we've been doing events like this for Mental Health Awareness Month for a few years now, and it's really been a powerful part of what we do. So I encourage people who are listening to think about ways they might want to connect or support they might need.
So NAMI is nationwide, probably international, am I correct? You have branches everywhere.
In the U.S. I'm not sure if outside of the U.S. I would say the same thing.
All right, then. Well, thank you. Anyone else with any comments before we close? I know it's been a while. Anyone else?
I just have to say that this is wonderful, and thank you for having us on this, and your show is great. I would say my one-word answer to your question about poetry and you know, in mental health is release, you know?
Yes.
I definitely felt that today in talking with you all and sharing, and you all very much inspired me. So thank you, and thank you, Michael.
Thank you. All right.
Steve.
All right. Anyone else before we close? Any final comments?
I just want to thank everybody.
Thank you for having
this
space.
All right. There's Skaya. And then I think there may be Benjamin, I believe. Skaya, please share.
Thank you for having the space.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We need to do this kind of program more often. Benjamin, what about you, sir?
Nope, just the same thing. This was really lovely, and I really appreciate being here with everybody. So thank you all, and thank you, Michael.
Nicholas? All right,
yeah,
thank you.
I wanted to thank everybody for agreeing to come through and share their experience. I really appreciate the vulnerability that everybody had coming to the table and just bearing themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not easy sharing your story. It's not easy allowing to hear words that you feel about yourself, that it's important that you share. All right, everyone. Thank you so much. And to our listening audience, as I share with you every time we're together, let poetry ring somewhere throughout the land. Take care. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Goodbye, everyone.
Quintessential Listening, Poetry Online Radio, is available on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. You can also check out the website at qlpor.com.